Welcome to the Magnificast, a podcast about Christianity and leftist politics. I'm your co-host, Dean Detloff.
And I'm your other co-host, Matt Bernico.
Matt, we had a good time last week with all these goofy jokes coming back after a couple of weeks of not doing a podcast. But it feels like now we've run out of excuses. We have to go back to what we do best, reading some books and talking it through. And Matt and I have been both taking up a new hobby lately. I don't know how. I feel like, Matt, we have like a weird serendipitous life where we seem to both be interested in the same hobbies at the same time, such that we can have a podcast about an incredibly niche topic. And I'm glad that this time our interests are converging on the topic of photography. And before you stop this podcast and think, I don't care about photography at all, we're going to try to convince you that actually you should. And in fact, there is a natural link between photography and Christianity and the left and the things that we talk about on this show all the time. And this is going to be one of those episodes where it's true, we're indulging maybe an interest here a little bit, but I think you'll be surprised by the end of this hour just how connected such a theme is to all the other stuff that we talk about on this podcast. What do you think, Matt? Do you think we can pull that off? Can we convince a listener by the end that it will have been worth it to sit through an hour of us talking about photography?
Oh, yeah. I'm very confident that that's the case.
All right. Great. So that's the deal that we're making with you, dear listener. If you get to the end of this episode and you think it was worth it, why don't you just tell us on Twitter? And if you get to the end of this and you don't think it was worth it, you can just keep that to yourself. So let's maybe start. We're coming in hot here, but I'm just excited to talk about it. I want to start with maybe the reason that Matt and I started thinking about some of these connections and wanting to do a whole episode about it. Matt, what if I told you that liberation theology, it's great, but it's mostly books, and maybe there was another way to think about liberation theology? Would that be of interest to you?
That would be great, yeah. If liberation theology was more than just some books, I would like that a lot.
And what if I told you that not only is it more than books, it's even more than podcasting. You don't even have to listen to people just talk about it. There are so many other genres and means by which one might encounter liberation theology. Would that be of interest to you?
Oh, yeah, big time. That's even better than not just books.
Great. I'm feeling like a real car salesman here. Well, you're in luck because, in fact, there are lots of interesting kind of means of connecting to liberation theology. And because it is a kind of religious movement that really got going in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, it coincided also with some really interesting other trends like journalism, photojournalism, kind of people thinking about how to represent the world and engage in different struggles in different ways. And doing some research for something else, I came across this really interesting person not too long ago named Mev Puleo. She is a U.S. citizen and a photographer. And I found out about her because she published this really interesting book called The Struggle is Won. And I found it because it's essentially interviewing a bunch of liberation theologians, and that is what I was interested in at the time. But I discovered a deeper interest in it, which is that as a photographer, she was also taking these really interesting images and taking pictures of both theologians and also just kind of people that she was meeting in Latin America, documenting people's struggles, trying to communicate about those struggles also in a different way, in a way that's, you know, not just reading a book or not just text. And it really got me thinking about, okay, well, what is the role of these other kind of artistic media, artistic forms in communicating something about liberation and struggles and so on? And I mentioned Matt and I have been kind of having this burgeoning interest in photography lately, so it was very convenient to all of a sudden find a photographer working on liberation theology from the U.S. Matt, you've been looking at some Mev Puleo photos and some of the books that she's been involved with as well. Anything sticking out to you about her right away?
Yeah. So I've taken a look through her book called The Struggle is Won, Voices and Visions of Liberation, which is rad. A rad book that you can get on archive.org. One of my favorite places to get books that are out of print and hard to find. But also, Dean, maybe a few years ago now, for my birthday, you sent me Ernesto Cardenal's book about love. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it features a few of her photographs as well, which is just a good demonstration of the ways that she is like pretty embedded in the liberation theology movement, that like her pictures kind of pop up a lot of different places. But I think what's really interesting about her work, especially in The Struggles One, but I mean, I think anywhere, is that she's photographing people who are from, well, in a lot of cases in this book, from Nicaragua, but also from other places throughout Latin America. Nicaragua is the big one, I think, given the time she was kind of doing these things, that all makes sense in, you know, is not strange, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But the thing that's cool about it, though, is that she is a person, like you said, who's from the United States, who is visiting Nicaragua, who is taking these pictures and not doing it voyeuristically, but she's taking the pictures, she's having conversations and building relationships with these people in Nicaragua, which I think is pretty interesting. So what's cool is that it's not just photography for the sake of photography. It's not taking a picture because it looks cool. But it's like building a relationship with somebody, and it's also finding a way to bring that person with her to the United States and back to her community of people. Interestingly enough, Mev Pueblo and her husband lived in St. Louis and have an affiliation with St. Louis University, which I have no strong feelings about the university itself. They are undergoing right now. The grad student workers there are unionizing, or trying to at least, so solidarity to them. But anyways, unrelated. An interesting connection to my life, I suppose. But anyways, Mev Pueblo, she's building these relationships with people in Nicaragua. She's taking their photos. She's bringing them with them to her community and like trying to find ways to tell their story and build that sort of sense of solidarity between Christians throughout the world. Which I think is really fascinating, a really cool thing. When I used to teach media studies a long time ago, real MagnifiCast heads will remember those episodes for sure. I would have this conversation with students about, like, you know, why do we make media? What's the point of, like, producing content? Is it just to post it on the internet and get subscribers? No, probably not. I hope not. Please don't let that be the case. But it is because of, I mean, in some way it's related to the ideas that you even get in something like the Magnificat, right? To lift up the lowly means to be able to tell the stories of people who might not have, you know, any other means to have their story told. So I think there's like some really interesting connections between doing journalistic work and doing, you know, photography work, and also being a Christian person who's like interested in solidarity. All that being said, I'm out there taking pictures all the time. I'm really like trying to hone my skills and figure out how my camera works. And I'm not doing that cool work. I'm not anywhere interesting taking pictures and talking to people, but I think it's cool to find that connection and like maybe resonate with it a bit.
Yeah, exactly. She is an inspiring person, somebody who makes me want to take pictures, but also makes me feel inadequate to the the job of taking pictures, for now anyway. But one thing that I thought was really interesting, I came across this kind of story about her. I can't remember where this is exactly, but anyway, there's a story of her at the Mary Knoll Seminary in New York, associated with the Mary Knoll missionaries, who, if you don't know who the Mary Knollers are, they're basically like the conduit of liberation theology into North America, for sure. They translated a ton of books. They run Orbis Books still to this day. Great people to know about. But she was at this Mary Knoll Seminary, and she was talking to, I think, Juan Segundo, a Jesuit liberation theologian, who is a very powerful writer and interesting guy. So she's talking to this guy, and she's sort of saying something like, oh, you know, I'm not a liberation theologian, so what can I really contribute? And his reply was, well, we don't just need theologians, we need liberation photographers, we need liberation accountants. Basically, we need everybody to come into the struggle with the skills that they have and the interests that they have and what they're kind of able to contribute. And that's the kind of philosophy that really informs her own work. And Matt and I were maybe just talking about this in general and being like, what a cool thing, and kind of sets our mind off in different directions. And as people who also just recently started trying to take pictures and figure out what's going on with them and so on, you learn pretty quickly that a thing like photography is actually not something you just sort of pick up and start doing. I mean, you can do it with your phone or whatever, and that's cool. But there's all kinds of other things happening. And as soon as you start thinking about liberation photography, you also start thinking about all the other ways that photography is used in oppression, other ways that it's used in struggling for liberation, and what it means to kind of live in a society that's sort of surrounded by photography one way or the other. Media, TV, we see images all the time, constantly throughout the day, more than any other generation of human beings on the planet. And so we thought, okay, we're going to do an episode thinking about photography. We're going to think about cameras. We're going to think about images. We're going to talk it through. And you're going to, I guess, dear listener, have to indulge us just getting really nerdy about photography philosophy. But I think there's something there. And maybe we can find the thread by the time we get to the end.
I picked up photography maybe a while ago when I was working, when I started working in unions and stuff. I was not much of a photographer before that, but I got a camera and I went to strikes and I started taking pictures of people, and I thought that was really exciting and pretty cool. And sometimes the pictures were good and sometimes they weren't, but I always felt like, you know, being in that space and being able to like just snap a few pictures of people doing something that is, I think, pretty extraordinary, was powerful, and being able to show it to people on the internet was pretty powerful. So that's, anyways, I got into it because it was my job for a hot minute. and now I'm like kind of doing it in a different capacity. But I guess what like really drew you to doing this in the first place, or like why was this a weird niche thing that you were interested in?
That's a great question. I don't have a very good answer to it, except that a friend of mine is somebody who takes a lot of pictures. I don't know if he would say he's a photographer or not, but has a lot of cool cameras and so on. And I was reading a bunch of philosophy about photography lately, also just thinking about how we live in such a like media-saturated culture and society. And this friend of mine was like, well, if you ever just want to borrow a camera and try to think about it from that side of the equation, you can. So I did, and I borrowed it and thought it was really weird and challenging and fun. So not related to taking pictures of people on strike, but definitely related to existential questions, I guess, of being like, I live in a society constantly pummeled by by the products of these machines, but I don't know anything about them or how they work. So now I'm just compelled to figure it out.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty good reason to figure it out, though. That's cool. Well, I think a way to get to the bottom of like what we're doing when we take pictures, and like maybe the ways that we might want to leverage, you know, what we're doing when we're taking pictures, is to understand the whole thing a bit more philosophically. I guess maybe unhelpful to some people, but at least very helpful to me. There is one person, one philosopher in particular that I would go to if I wanted to know about photography, and I do. And that person is called Willem Flusser. Willem Flusser was a Czech-born Jewish-Brazilian philosopher, writer, and journalist. A wild guy who lived a pretty incredible life. And I'll tell you a little bit about it right now, and then I'll tell you about his book that he wrote about photography. So Willem Flusser, he started studying philosophy in Prague in 1938. And you could probably connect the dots in your own brain as a Jewish person in 1938 in Prague. Not a great spot. So Flusser fled the country with the family that he would later marry into. Interesting story in and of itself. But he fled the country because of the Nazis occupying the country. Again, you probably caught on to that already. At first, Flusser went to London. He ended up, though, staying in not London at all, not even Europe, but Brazil. And in Brazil, he ended up teaching courses in philosophy and communication, even though he like never really had a degree in those things or never completed a degree in those things. He and his wife eventually moved back to Europe and lived in France until he died in 1991, which is good for him. An interesting life, though, full of lots of tumultuous times. But Flusser's work is, I think, really what makes me fascinated in him. He is usually lumped in with like media theory, which isn't necessarily wrong, but his writing is like way more philosophical than anything that you'd usually find in media theory or media studies or even cultural studies. It's like he's trying to do phenomenology, he's trying to do existentialism, but he's not going to use any of those words to describe what he's doing. He's going to talk about it in all kinds of other terms, which I think are great. It's really hard to categorize his thinking as being really about one thing. I mean, he's talking about media, he's talking about technology, he's talking about squids, he's talking about the devil, he's talking about all kinds of different things. Religion, that's another one. But he's always, I think, like focusing on tools and observations about phenomenology, about those tools. to say something interesting about human beings in the world, like existentially. It's this really interesting, weird approach to, like, I think existential philosophy, but it gets there through way of like the philosophy of technology or of media studies. So the book we're going to talk about specifically from Flusser today, we're actually going to talk about two of them, but one mainly. So there's a book that he has called Toward a Philosophy of Photography, and there's also another book that he has called Gestures, which is a book that is about a lot of things. It's a book about phenomenology, and there's a section in it about photography that's, I think, worth talking about. The book Toward a Philosophy of Photography is really interesting because, like I mentioned it a minute ago, it's a book about photography. That's true. It's also, though, a book about like humanity's position within a world where photography and like the production of images is just sort of the norm. So it's about photography proper. That's totally true. It's not about how to like set your shutter speed or like what type of film to use. He's not really interested in those questions. Those are like, you know, interesting in and of themselves, I suppose. I mean, I think it's actually kind of boring, but he is really interested in talking about like, what are we doing when we're photographing something? And like, what does it mean to be a person who is photographing? And what does it mean to live in a world where photographs are everywhere? Lots of big questions, I think, from Flusser. Dean, what's your take on the book?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, all kind of interesting to hear from somebody who died in 1991, like before the internet, you know, forced us to look at images basically constantly all day. And I think that is pretty interesting. So, I mean, I always see Flusser as like an extremely 20th century person who is writing about the 21st century in some interesting ways. I think he's an important person to read in general and kind of an underrated guy just because he has a lot of different perspectives as like a several times minoritized person who ended up living in Brazil in particular, which gives him a particular vantage point maybe to think about these kinds of things. But when it comes to photography in particular, and especially this question of kind of what is like a liberation philosophy of photography, I think he's somebody who's really unique. Sometimes you read other people talking about photography, like Susan Sontag or Roland Barthes or many other people. And I mean, it's great. Letting people overthink things like photography is always really fun. But photography is something that I think a lot of people who are intellectuals kind of naturally hate or like naturally very suspicious of, maybe is a better way of putting it. And for good reason. I mean, anybody who lives in a mediatized society, I think over time you become kind of suspicious of advertising and the way that, you know, the spectacle is getting at you. Flusser, though, is distinct because he is also suspicious of images and photography, but not absolutely. Like, he's more like, what if we thought really hard about this in such a way that we could sort of have a relationship of intentionality toward the society that we live in? And maybe I'll just read a quote that I really like from this book that sort of sums up how he thinks about photography and this kind of question of freedom and liberation. So he says, "Everything is becoming absurd, so where's the room for human freedom? We discover people who can perhaps answer this question, photographers. They are already in miniature people of the apparatus future. Their acts are programmed by the camera, they play with symbols, they're active in these different sectors, interested in information, they create things without value, and in spite of this, they consider their activity to be anything but absurd, and they think that they're acting freely. The task of the philosophy of photography is to question photographers about freedom, to probe their practice in the pursuit of freedom." And then he goes on to talk about kind of how they do that. He says, "Photographers show that you can outwit the camera's rigidity. You can smuggle human intentions into its program that are not predicted by it. You can force the camera to create the unpredictable, the improbable, the informative. You can show contempt for the camera and its creation and turn one's interest away from the thing in general in order to concentrate on information." And he says, "In short, freedom is the strategy of making chance and necessity subordinate to human intention. Freedom is playing against the camera." A lot of big thoughts here. I think it's great. Philosophy language really makes you think. What I like about it is Flisser is talking about this sort of interesting paradox that in this mediatized society, everything feels so absurd precisely because we're surrounded by these technical images, these things that are, you know, kind of real and unreal at the same time, pictures of products, advertisements for things that may or may not be true, all kind of attested to by images. So you might think that the person who makes those images is probably the most, like, oppressed of all, or the agent of oppression, or however you might put it. But Flisser thinks that there's actually something more interesting going on there, that if you can kind of contextualize what it is that produces that situation of absurdity, you can kind of get maybe a more, you can like make more sense of it. You can create some intentionality with respect to it. And to me, at least, when I was kind of reading that, you know, seeking to understand like what's going on in the world around me, all of a sudden I was like, whoa, maybe there's kind of a way to turn this whole situation around, at least in at an individual level, where you're not like completely bowled over by all the images around you, but you can kind of, you know, take up a purposeful relationship with respect to image making and images and so on that gives you a little more agency or a little more room. So I don't know. That's the thing that really sticks out to me in Flisser with photography, is that kind of like question of freedom is a fundamental question that that cameras allow you to ask when you're surrounded by images all the time.
Yeah, that rules. I think what I like about that insight from Flisser is that, you know, when it comes to thinking about technology and how we're doing things with technology, with our tools, with our stuff in the world, right? Sometimes people tend to be dumb in two different directions. The first direction is to be like a complete technological libertarian, to be, you know, this is the position in which guns don't kill people, people kill people. Like technology is just like sort of like an inert sort of thing in the world that has no particular potential besides what a person can do with it, you know, that sucks, I think is a failure to understand tools and what happens to humans when they use things, or enter into relationships with them, to even be more philosophical about it. The other way you can be dumb is to be like overly deterministic about technology and to be like, well, we're only just carrying out the programs of the things that we have and we're all just cogs in the machine and all this kind of stuff as well. But I like what Flisser is getting at better, because it is, I think, more true and also constructive about the way that we use things, where we're playing against the apparatus of the camera. We can take it and do all kinds of things with it that might be, yeah, I like the phrase like smuggling in human intention. I think that is really cool. But I think that's like a great insight into not just photography, but I think also to other types of like media art and maybe just art in general. But in a lot of ways, art is about overcoming those particular boundaries of a medium, or at least like pushing up against those boundaries or being playful with them. So to recognize that that is something that you can do with photography is, I think, a bit liberating. That it's not just, you know, complete freedom or complete determinism. There's something in the middle where you're trying to like you're playing a game against this this weird little box you're carrying around.
Yeah, and I think that is even more important to think about, because it's not the case anymore that the box is something you have to go out and kind of buy and learn, and there's maybe like a big learning curve to figuring it out, you know, how do apertures work, how do shutter speeds work, all that kind of stuff. Instead, everybody has a camera on them all the time in their pockets, as long as you have a smartphone. You're probably listening to this this podcast on a camera device right now. I like calling my phone a little computer now. That's my new thing. It's a little computer that also has a phone in it, or also has a camera in it, and a phone, I guess. But the point being, this kind of apparatus that you can play against is something that's constantly with us, even to the point of being frustrating. You know, people talk about the kind of banality of like Instagramming your breakfast or whatever, or the I don't know, all the weird kind of social comparisons that people make on an app like Instagram, just by virtue of having access to so many images, so many comparative images. And I think what Flisser kind of challenges us to do is to say, well, if you have a camera on you all the time and you're feeling sort of like sucked in by it and by the kinds of things that it produces or gives rise to, You could actually like get weird with that in a way that gives you a little more freedom with respect to it. Like if you took the time to figure out, you know, what are the limitations of your camera phone or other kind of cameras and so on, you start to demystify it a little bit. It's kind of a weird analogy, but the thing that came to my mind when I was thinking about this is actually sort of like what Marx does with the commodity, where you're like, the commodity appears in this weird fetishized way. It kind of has this power over you. But if you can break it down and like figure out where it comes from and how it works, you get a little bit more freedom with respect to it. You know, you kind of understand a little bit better what's happening such that you can act in a different way. So I think there's something that's even more relevant maybe now in what Flisser's doing than when he was writing, you know, in the 80s and into the early 90s.
Well, let's get into the book a bit and then we can, I don't know, figure out what any of this might mean for anybody listening. Okay. So this book is called Toward a Philosophy of Photography. And the book starts off with some interesting insight. He kind of starts at like the most basic principles, I think, because he's a good philosopher. And he builds up towards photography and maybe some more ideas about like artistic freedom and like what does it mean existentially to take a picture of something. So from very basic to very big. But even the very basic seems pretty complicated, actually. So the book starts off with this paragraph I think is maybe a good framing for, I think, how big he's thinking. So Flisser writes, "The book is based on the hypothesis that two fundamental turning points can be observed in human culture since its inception. The first, around the middle of the second millennium BC, can be summed up under the heading, the invention of linear writing. A big moment for humans. We love it. shout out to those humans who did linear writing. I think it's great. The second, the one we are currently experiencing, could be called the invention of the technical image." So these are the ways that Flisser thinks about history. Humans are often, I think... I mean, like, you know, what does it mean to be a human person? A big existential question. Who could possibly answer it? At least part of the answer, though, is like, you know, what is it that humans do? That's what makes them, you know, what they are, right? So linear writing is a pretty big part of being human and the human experience and human culture. Like, you basically can't have any of that without the technology of writing in a particular line, usually from left to right, but maybe from right to left or up and down, who knows, all kinds of different ways you can write in linear fashion. But just the very existence of that particular type of technology makes all kinds of things possible, not just literature or poetry or whatever, but like loggable human history. So that's step one. And then the second one that he has, the second like bifurcation here, is the invention of the technical image as being like, that's like the second epoch of humanity, right? the first building block is linear writing, and second is the technical image. He means something specific by this that we're going to get to in a minute, but maybe first we can talk about images. Dean, do you want to talk about just what an image is? Not a technical image, just an image.
Sure. What an incredibly difficult thing, actually, for a Christian person to talk about.
I know.
A very evocative term. I'll tell you what Flisser means, maybe, because I think there's some really funny like theological analogies to draw there, but he says this. "Images signify mainly something out there in space and time that they have to make comprehensible to us as abstractions, as reductions of the four dimensions of space and time to the two surface dimensions." So when you take a picture, this is not Flisser, this is me. When you take a picture, you're translating what you see in the world into, you know, a flat piece of paper or print. He says, "This specific ability to abstract surfaces out of space and time and to project them back into space and time is what is known as imagination. It's the precondition for the production and decoding of images. In other words, the ability to encode phenomena into two-dimensional symbols and to read these symbols." So, I mean, this is like a, I don't know, it's like reading a car manual version of like what you experience every single day. Like when you like look at a picture, you know, like, and on the one hand, it's common sense. When you look at a picture, you're looking at a two-dimensional plane. And you're, you know, if it's like a good photograph, you might also have a sense of kind of depth, or it might kind of pull you in and you can see some layers and so on. But at the end of the day, this image has been abstracted from the reality, where you could actually navigate those layers, and it's been frozen into this two-dimensional plane. And that is a pretty powerful thing for humans to be able to do. This is one of the big things that Flisser talks about a lot, that even when it comes to something like film, you know, which is made up of many of these images kind of all strung together in different facets, that is kind of an epoch-changing thing. It changes our perception of the world. It changes the ways that we kind of represent the world to ourselves, how we manipulate the world, what we think about even our relationship to things like truth, or, you know, how we might be faithful to the world and so on. So I think there's lots more to be said, but in the most basic sense, for Flusser, images are these kind of signifiers of what's going on out there in space and time. They remind you of something else, you know, a moment that no longer exists.
Yeah, exactly. That makes a lot of sense. It is the car manual version, for sure, of what we're experiencing all the time. And when Flusser's talking about images, he's talking about not photographs necessarily. He's talking about, like, representational art that's trying to tell you something. Throughout the book, he always returns back to this idea of the Etruscan tomb and, like, a painting on the wall or something. But what he's talking about here are, like first level abstractions, like, you know, you've seen an event that's happened in your daily life. I don't know, a new person is king, and then you go and paint a picture of the new king, right? And it's like, it's an abstraction because you're taking something that's happened and you're, you know, putting it on the wall or whatever. So it's abstracted from history. It's kind of solidified as a particular event. Okay, an image, you gotta have them. You gotta love them. Okay. In a lot of ways, too, probably existed before linear writing. But then we get to technical images, which is maybe the next step in the extremely abbreviated history of humanity. So this is a bit of a long quote from him. Maybe I'll stop in a few places to kind of talk about it more. So technical images, on the other hand, different than images, different than writing. The technical image, this is Flusser, is an image produced by apparatuses, as apparatuses themselves are the products of applied scientific texts. In the case of technical images, one is dealing with the indirect products of scientific texts. This gives them historically and ontologically a position that is different from traditional images. Ontologically, traditional images are abstractions of the first order insofar as they are abstract from the concrete world, while technical images are abstractions of the third order. They abstract from texts, which abstract from traditional images, which themselves abstract from the concrete world. This is like, I know, exactly. This is like, you know, you're doing some philosophy here when you've got this level of bullshit going on, I think. But this is what he means. Technical images, they're created by apparatuses, by which he means, like, a camera is a thing that, it's an apparatus. We'll talk about apparatuses again in a minute. Apparatus is one of those, like, those big, like, end of the 20th century of philosophical terms that, like, everybody wrote about for some reason, like Foucault, Deleuze, Flusser, they all have something. Oh, and Agamben too has a big thing about apparatuses. Everyone loves these things, whatever they are.
or anyways, hates them. They love to talk about them.
They love to talk about them. That's exactly right. loving to hate something or to complain about it is like the best thing for philosophers. So what are you saying here, though, about the ontology, or how a technical image is ontologically different than a traditional image, is that it's not just an abstraction. It's like you didn't just see a king ascend to the throne and then you painted a picture of it. You saw the king do it. You have this little box and you snapped a picture of the king ascending to the throne, right? But when you're doing that, when you're taking the picture, when you're abstracting it at this third order of abstraction or whatever from the concrete world, you're also using like the visual language of the regular image, right? You're composing it in the same way that you might also compose a painting. You're looking for the symbols that are communicated in that moment that people will kind of like recognize after the fact, and you're grabbing them with your camera. So you're abstracting it from the world by a sort of scientific means in a way that's different, different than a regular like painted image or a drawn image or something. Even if it's photorealistic, it's different. So Flusser goes on to say this: technical images are difficult to decode for a strange reason. To all appearances, they do not have to be decoded, since their significance is automatically reflected on their surface. What one sees on them, therefore, do not appear to be symbols that one has to decode, but symptoms of the world through which, even if directly, is to be perceived. So this is the next piece, I think, that is really fascinating about photography as like sort of a weird thing in the world is that when you see a picture of something, I mean, there's all kinds of extremely famous photographs, right? You can think of like the an image of some of the first man walking on the moon, or you know, there's that really famous like protest photograph of a woman putting like a flower into the rifle of a National Guardsman, right? An important image for our time, especially during a week where that's been happening on college campuses across the United States and even in Europe. Surprise. But anyways, when we're doing that, you know, you're looking at a picture and you think that you're seeing through it transparently, like you're perceiving the image as it is, and there's like no mediation between what you're seeing and what happened. But that's not really true. And that's not how photography works, because when you're taking a picture, you're composing, you're like reacting to a moment that's happening, yes. But you're also like adjusting your camera to take in light in a particular way. You're standing at a particular angle to frame the picture just so. Maybe later you crop it, you bump up certain levels of color. You can, you know, you can do endless regimes of editing and so on. But all I'm trying to say is that the technical image appears to be something that you don't have to decode. Like there's no symbolism in it that you have to take apart like you would, you know, a painting or something like that. That's how it appears. But what Flitzer wants to tell us is that there's actually all kinds of other like little nuances happening on the surface of the technical image that we don't really recognize because of the ways that the scientific reason is behind the scenes and kind of mixing with human intention. And it's just hard to kind of know, but it's all happening in the background. I guess all this to say, a picture is not like a transparent window into something that happened. It's also, you know, has all kinds of intentionality. You have to decode things. It means something to have a picture oriented in a particular way and so on.
Yeah. And to be clear, Flitzer is not talking about like, you know, weird photographic art or people kind of making abstract photographs or all that kind of stuff. He's talking about, I don't know, more everyday photographs or journalistic photographs or even, I mean, photos that are maybe brought into like consumer capitalism and so on, but in such a way that it's like, if you take this pill, then this will happen to you or whatever. The images, you know, they suggest maybe something transparent, as you said, Matt, but in fact, like, we're already kind of engaged in all this weird like decoding or failure to recognize that we're decoding of these images all the time. And I guess one spoiler is that eventually Flitzer will say part of the freedom that photographers can offer is trying to like mess with that or trying to remind us that we are actually looking at a technically produced image, an image made by a machine, a camera. And there's lots of ways that photographers can do that. But one of the ironies is that photographers often also try not to do that or try to, you know, move the apparatus as far out of the process as possible. They want to capture your gaze in a way that you forget that you're looking at a photograph. But Flitzer is like, it's actually really good to remind people that they're engaging an image on purpose in a weird way.
Yeah, totally. And I think that there's also like a weird allergy within people's brains, or at least this is like an observation from my perspective as a person who thinks about media, I guess. But like sometimes when you start explaining this about photographs, people will take like the takeaway will be like, oh, so photography is not capturing like an authentic moment, and therefore it's like more manipulation and maybe like bad or dishonest type of art or something. And I think that's not true. That's not the case. That's not what Flitzer's saying at all. It's just like, that's just what photography is. You know, like photography is like playing with symbols. It's playing with moments. It's reacting to moments. It's like, you know, there's intentionality in it. There's luck in it. And all of it is just like, that's fine. It's not bad because it's like not a true window into what happened, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Right. People get too weird about authenticity. Who cares about authenticity? Right. Get it out of there.
That's right. Well, speaking of that, maybe this is a good moment to pivot also from images to the apparatus. So if you have a technical image, that image has to be produced by an apparatus. You need a technical apparatus to make that kind of image. And this is the kind of thing that if you're a huge philosophy nerd will make you want to buy a camera, or at least that is my experience. Literally, I was reading this in Flitzer and I was like, I want one of these. I want one of these weird apparatuses, which most people call cameras. So Flitzer says this: the Latin word apparatus is derived from the verb apparare, meaning to prepare. Alongside this, there exists in Latin the verb preparare, likewise meaning to prepare. To illustrate in English the difference between the prefixes ad and pre, one could perhaps translate apparare with prepare, using pro instead of for. Accordingly, an apparatus would be a thing that lies in wait or in readiness for something, and a preparatus would be a thing that waits patiently for something. The photographic apparatus lies in wait for photography. It sharpens its teeth in readiness. The kind of thing that only a weird phenomenologist in media could write. He goes on to say, if one considers the camera and apparatuses in general in this sense, one sees that the camera produces symbols, symbolic surfaces that have in a certain way been prescribed for it. The camera is programmed to produce photographs, and every photograph is a realization of one of the possibilities contained within the program of the camera. So this, again, might sound like common sense, but it actually is really interesting to kind of break it apart. What Flitzer is saying is a camera can only really see what the camera is prepared to see. And it's always going to be prepared with a number of different factors. So when you take out your phone and you take a picture, I think it's actually kind of harder to get this point because camera phones, they take pictures in ways that take a lot of the guesswork out of it for you. I mean, you can like put filters on it and so on afterwards and all that kind of stuff. Like you can manipulate the image that you get. But for the most part, you know, if you just snap a picture, you're kind of letting the device do all the thinking for you to get the right exposure of light, to capture a moment, you know, as it's passing you by and so on. It's easier if you've ever had like a more manual camera where you can adjust all kinds of different settings, and then the image that you get is the one that you kind of prepared the camera to see. But camera phones are also doing that. It's just that you're not as involved in the preparation process, or you're not making the camera prepare itself to receive a certain image. But what I think is really fascinating is Flitzer's talking about how apparatuses are these things that, you know, we sort of set them up to be prepared to take a photograph. They lie in wait for photography. They wait around for a person to take a picture. And there's this kind of interesting dialogue between human beings and apparatuses, or between machines, or between even structures or infrastructures. You can kind of scale this insight up to a lot of different areas. But there's a dialogue between us and the things that we use. We're always kind of using technology to prepare it in certain ways, or maybe we're not doing that enough with enough intentionality. And that's kind of what the camera suggests, is that we have the ability to prepare things. And once you kind of prepare that technology, you've only done it in one of many possible ways. And I think it's really interesting for Flitzer to kind of point this out, because when you see an image, you know, again, sometimes you might see an image in such a way where you're like, oh, I forget that that is a photograph. But if you see an image and you kind of think about how it was photographed, and how photography works and so on, it opens up a range of possibilities that there were many other ways someone could have taken a particular photograph. They could have moved around the subject in a different way. They could have increased or decreased the lighting. Maybe their shutter could have been faster or slower. All kinds of different choices that have to get made, either by you or by the machine itself, to get this particular image. And Flitzer's trying to give us a more intentional way of looking at that process, instead of kind of allowing ourselves to be maybe like sucked into the machine's way of thinking on its own without any involvement from us.
Yep. I think it's good insight. And without that recognition, you do not think about the, you know, a camera, an apparatus as something that you can struggle against or maybe like do something different with. Cool. Let's put a pin in that for a hot second and let's move on towards something else. So Flitzer is always somebody who's like, he's interested in talking about like what is a tool doing that we're using, and how does that tool like affect us, or what are humans doing when they're like using it in a real philosophical way? And Flitzer has a really particular way of talking about things that humans do in with their tools. And I think other philosophers might just call this like phenomenology or something. Like, I don't know. Derrida has a book called The Truth in Painting. And it's a phenomenology of painting, right? in like, what is a human doing when they're painting? But Flusser, instead of relying on like, I think, big philosophical terms like phenomenology, he talks about things in a little bit of like a more of accessible way, which I really appreciate because, man, if there's one thing I don't need in my life anymore is like French guys talking about stuff that is over my head. So Flusser has this term that he uses called gestures. He has a whole book called Gestures. Gestures are a thing that humans do with intentionality with tools. So that is like a very broad thing, but Flusser thinks it's really interesting to look at the world from this perspective of like human gestures, because in them are bound up all kinds of assumptions that humans have about themselves in the world and what does it mean to be a person. He thinks that, like, you know, if you want to know something like existentially true about humans, you should look at the ways that they are interacting with tools, or what are they doing with tools in the world. Again, you know, humans are what they do. This is sort of like one of the grounding ideas, I guess. So Flusser has this book. It's called Gestures. And also in the other book that we've been talking about, Toward a Philosophy of Photography, he has a chapter called The Gesture of Photography. Man, gestures is such an interesting, I think, framework for thinking about humans and their use of tools. He has, you know, sections and ideas about, you know, the gesture of writing, the gesture of speaking. How is, you know, a human speaking different than a bird chirping is a question that Flusser is going to ask in a very interesting way. He'll also ask, like, what's the gesture of smoking a pipe? Or one of my favorite chapters in this book, sorry to get caught in a digression, but whatever, we're already doing it in this podcast.
This whole episode's a digression.
Big time. He has a section in this book called Gestures that's called The Gesture of Shaving, that I think is really fascinating. You know, something that no one's ever written very philosophically on. And it's interesting because he's like, yeah, shaving, this thing that you do with a razor, what's that gesture like? What does it mean for humans to do that? Well, it's kind of like cutting your lawn. And he has this whole kind of explanation about how to cut your beard, to shave, to give yourself a close shave, is to define a stark boundary between you and the world. And it's just this really, I mean, it maybe sounds like bonkers when I'm just saying it decontextualized, but I promise it's actually very interesting. So all that to say, there's a gesture of photography as well, because it's a gesture, like I said a minute ago, is like any intentional action you're going to undertake with a tool, with a device, with an apparatus, with whatever, with a shaving blade, a shaving razor. So the gesture of photography, though, is an interesting one, because what you're doing is, here, I'll put it, I'll give it to you in his words, and I'll give you two different reads on the gesture of photography from two different sources, but I think each are interesting. So here's the first one. If one observes the movements of a human being in possession of a camera, or of a camera in possession of a human being, very funny, but a philosophically important distinction that Flusser makes in this book that maybe we'll talk about in a minute, the impression given is of someone lying in wait. This is the ancient act of stalking, which goes back to the Paleolithic hunter of the tundra. Yet photographers are not pursuing their game in the open savanna, but in the jungle of cultural objects, and their tracks can be traced through this artificial forest. I think this is a cool way of talking about photography, or at least maybe a semi-illuminating way of talking about photography, because that is kind of what it feels like to take pictures. If you ever show up to... I mean, first of all, I think the basic assumption here is actually a really good one that is maybe not one that you'd assume from the very beginning, that you're showing up to a place to take pictures, right? You're trying to catch a particular event. You're taking a picture of something. Whereas, like, if you were painting a picture, you know, you're painting a landscape or something, you're trying to accentuate something in particular. You're trying to communicate, like, something in a different way. You're not trying to, like, you know, you're not like painting something and wait for the perfect thing to happen in front of you. You're painting the thing that you want to happen in front of you. Whereas you're taking a photograph, you're taking a picture of something, you're waiting for that moment to happen so you can snap it, you can take it out. When I was doing a lot of union photography of strikes and so on, I was always waiting for like two or three things to happen. One is for a picture of a worker to be like marching out of their workplace on strike. That was the first one. Usually I'd take a video of that. The second, the workers who are on strike standing together in some kind of like unified pose. And then maybe a third one is like one of them speaking, but in a really animated way, right? So I would take a ton of pictures of all of the stuff because I'm waiting for the exact right moment and to snatch it out of time. And it has to be the right moment because you're trying to communicate a particular set of ideas with your picture, right? You're playing with the symbols of, in my case, like a strike of defiance of all of these different ideas that are kind of happening behind the scenes. But anyways, that's one idea about the gesture of photography, what we're doing. We're hunting for the right moment to snap the picture.
Yeah, I mean, there's something, this metaphor comes up in a lot of other people as well writing about photography. It's kind of a classic one that the photographer is a bit of like a predator in a weird way. And like, sometimes it does feel very awkward to be a person holding a camera in the world, that you're kind of like objectifying the world in a way that you maybe don't, in a day to day. And also, if you're doing that in a crowd, for example, you might be objectifying the world around people who are not trying to objectify the world. And so you're basically negotiating all these kind of weird ethical boundaries of whether or not you might turn somebody into an object or not, whether they consent to that or not, and so on. Something a lot of photojournalists talk about, and interesting kind of ethical discourses there. A lot of things that Mev Puleo talks about as well in her own work in doing liberation photography. But all that to say, it's an interesting thing. And also the object theme, an interesting thing that comes up a lot in Flitzer.
Yeah, definitely. Well, here's another bit about the gesture of photography, but it complicates the gesture of photography in that it makes it really hard to even talk about what we're doing when we're taking a picture, or maybe it emphasizes the impossibility of authenticity or something, but we'll get to it maybe. So Flitzer says this: although this appears to be very simple, taking a picture, it's difficult. We have before us an ambiguous situation. Let's say it's a social event. A man is sitting in a chair smoking a pipe. This is my favorite thing to take pictures of. There's another man in the room holding an apparatus. Both are behaving in an unusual way, if by usual we mean appropriate to the event. The man smoking the pipe seems not to be doing it so to smoke, but for some other reason. Although we might find it difficult to say why, it seems to us that he's playing at smoking. The man with the apparatus, conversely, is moving around the area in a most peculiar way. If we set out to describe his path, then for us, he becomes the main point of the scene, and the smoker becomes the explanation for the way he's circling around the middle of the image. That's noteworthy, for it shows that the situation is determined not so much by the relationship among the constituent elements as by the observer's intentions. So this is not an objective description in the sense of being independent of the observer's point of view. Quite the contrary, the situation described here is a setup by the observer. But the setup is, of course, a photographic concept, which proves how difficult it is to leave the photographic model of the observation. So this is such a funny and stupid kind of thing, a way to talk about photography. Because not only, like, okay, there's a guy, he's taking a picture of another guy who's smoking the pipe. And the guy who's smoking the pipe is, like, posing. He's not really smoking, or he's not smoking because he wants to smoke. He's smoking because there's a guy taking the picture. But then there's another man in the scene who's watching the guy taking the picture of the man smoking. And even that guy who's, like, looking on at the scene is looking at the scene through a sort of photographic perspective or a lens. Or, like, you know, even recognizing that you're seeing a scene in front of you is a photographic way of thinking. I mean, the idea of a scene, right? A scene is like something that you set up in like a particular way so it looks a particular way, like as if they're on stage or it's a film, a film scene or something. All of this is very funny though, but it kind of demonstrates the ways of the layers of performance that are going on when you're doing photography, but also how complicated it can be in terms of, like, you know, the objectification of other people. And also, like, just how hard it actually is to define what you're doing when you're taking a picture. A lot of moving pieces in this explanation.
Yeah, this is what I mean too when I was sort of talking a bit about the negotiating kind of objectifying the world around you. And one funny thing that Flitzer talks about in this essay is that the photographer is kind of making an object out of the person smoking the pipe in this image. But the irony is that the good photograph, or the photograph the photographer really wants, is the one where the guy smoking a pipe sort of was caught off guard. Like, you want to get the picture that makes it look like he's actually smoking the pipe and looks like he's not really being photographed. That's what makes, you know, that's like the moment the photographer is kind of seeking or waiting around for, looking for, hunting around for. And I think that is also very funny, right? That there's this idea that the photographer is always objectifying the world, but the goal is to sort of do that in such a way that doesn't feel like you've made the world into an object. Lots of exceptions to that, obviously. People do that on purpose to different effect and so on. But in this example, Flitzer's trying to get at this weird interplay between the kind of subject's intention, the photographer's intention, and the object that they're intending toward. And I think what's really interesting to me about that gesture of photography is when you get into the kinds of photographs that we see in situations of real political struggle or challenge or suffering. Lots of literature written on that as well. But for example, Maeve Pelayo, she writes a lot about how when she's looking at a scene of suffering or photographing people who are having a hard time, like the negotiation that you have to do to figure out how can I do this in an ethical way that's not objectifying them in a negative way or exploiting them, but trying to, you know, say something with this photograph, do something with this photograph that pushes toward the alleviation of their suffering. Those are really interesting questions to ask and not questions that every photographer asks. And I think that's the kind of thing that Flitzer is also sort of forcing readers to contend with, is where are the kind of boundaries of being a subject, objectifying the world, and also being objectified by cameras, or being objectified by a world surrounded by technical images. That's kind of the dialogue or dialectic of freedom that Flitzer is really interested in. How do we get out from underneath the objectification of the world, knowing also that we're kind of engaging these apparatuses that always turn us into objects in these different ways? How do we kind of find our subjectivity there? And when it comes to things like liberation photography, that maybe gets like boosted up into a whole another layer. I think a lot about that too. Like, you know, so much of my life is spent like scrolling the internet to meaningful and meaningless effect. And obviously when there's something like a genocide going on in Palestine, or, you know, people are getting wrecked at like college campuses by these cops and stuff, you know, you're scrolling through an app and you're just seeing image after image of all this stuff kind of happening. And, you know, some images are like images that I would prefer not to see. And other images are images that I would take the time to see. Some images feel like they've maybe been, you know, the result of an exploitative situation or not true to what's going on. Others feel like it's important that these images have kind of come out or been shared. There's a lot of politics around images and lots of people writing about it. But I think Flitzer does a good job maybe giving us some philosophical framework to be like, what are we even doing when we take or consume a photograph?
Yeah, it does very much seem like a bedrock from which you can stand on to take a picture even, which I think is important. You know, maybe you're interested in photography, but you've probably never thought about these things. That's totally fine. But I think this is like a good way to kind of get started on interrogating the bigger ideas within photography and like, but also culturally, right? Like there's a huge cultural element to this and a huge political element to this. Right before I started preparing for this episode and reading this Flitzer book again, I did see this new Civil War movie, mm-hmm. the Alex Garland A24 Civil War movie. And I won't give any spoilers in case anyone wants to see it. I wasn't a huge fan of it. The whole movie is based around the story of these like war photographers who are cruising across the US and trying to take pictures of this like war torn country. And there's some interesting effects to that, you know. Usually, you know, you see war photography and it is in a place like Palestine, or it's in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever, a far off place that isn't home. And to see it happening in the United States is kind of an interesting thing. But I guess what I didn't like about the movie was that the photojournalists, the photographers, the war photographers, they were like extremely detached from the whole situation. So much so you don't really even know, like, is there a conflict in this side that is more morally correct than the others? No one asked that question, or nobody explained, you know, whether or not that was the case in this movie. An interesting thing. Anyways, it was just it felt more like the war photographers were there kind of like gawking at dead bodies than anything else. That was just the vibe from the movie that I got. And, you know, whatever, maybe just bad storytelling, or maybe something else is happening. I guess when it comes to like making media or taking pictures or just existing in the world, I guess what strikes me as an interesting thing, especially from the Mev Puleo kind of perspective, is that, like, are you doing it on the side of something, or are you just kind of doing it to, like, mm-hmm. gawk at somebody? Or, you know, like, what from where are you standing, and, like, where are you telling the story from? Because whether you think you're doing it or not, you are kind of telling a particular story when you take a picture of something. All of that to say is I think that pictures are, like you said, more politically and socially complex than first guess.
That's right. Well, there you have it. We promised at the end of this hour you would, I don't know, understand why this is relevant to this podcast. And hopefully we did make good on that promise. If we did, again, you can tweet us and tell us. And if we didn't, then you can keep that to yourself for sure. But I think what I think is really interesting about it as well, about Flusser's approach and kind of comparing it with that question that Segundo posed to Mev Puleo, or the suggestion rather, that we need different kinds of liberation activities out there in the world, or vocations. What I think is really interesting is that both of these kind of ways of talking about photography, either in this general philosophical sense, thinking about what photography does to us, what we do with it, and so on, and Mev Puleo's question about how do I do liberation photography, I think those kinds of things can get scaled up beyond cameras. You know, like, I think about it all the time when I write on my computer, or I have to produce a report, or do things in my day-to-day job, using technology, using other kind of outlets of expression, this podcast and other things too. How do we kind of take these talents and put them toward, you know, a good end? And I don't think people should be like constantly worried about like whether or not eating your lunch is like liberationist enough. But I think like it is important to, you know, consider like what are the avenues of maybe pushing the boulder either more toward liberation or more toward oppression based on the kinds of ways that we spend our time with different technical apparatuses in our life. So I don't know, get your camera phone out and take a weird picture and see how you feel about it. Maybe that's the moral of this podcast. Send us your weird pictures.
Thanks for listening to Magnificast. If you like what you heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/themagnificast. Our intro music is by Amaya Armstrong, and our outro music is by The Logical Spoon. And we'll see you next week.
Get up for church in the morning, souls alive. Heaven come to earth and there won't be no church. We'll meet down by the riverside. There we'll swim with all creation. Never get tired, never bored. Don't worry, someday there'll be no dam between us and our Lord.